Hello and welcome. I'm Tony Martinetti, the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Your small and mid-sized nonprofit has a home here at Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Last week, we put the focus on you as an individual, and we had a lot of tips for tuning up your retirement planning, and the focus was on you. This week, we're bringing the focus back to your nonprofit. My first guest after the break is going to be Stephanie Strom, reporter for the New York Times, and we're going to be talking about Failure Fair. That was a program sponsored by the World Bank. Should you be talking about mistakes and failures that your organization makes? It's good enough for the World Bank. I'll talk to Stephanie about her recent piece in the Times. And after Stephanie, I'll be joined by Ken Cerini, managing partner of Cerini & Associates. We're going to talk about financial freedom for your nonprofit and the potential loss of nonprofit status for those small organizations. And after Ken, I'll be joined by Gene Takagi, an attorney for nonprofits. Gene's going to share techniques to keep your board on board and keep your board out of trouble. All that this afternoon on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Stay with us for this break.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
Is your marriage in trouble? Are you considering divorce? Hello, I'm Lawrence Bloom, a family law attorney in New York and New Jersey. No one is happier than the day their divorce is final. My firm can help you. We take the nasty out of the divorce process and make people happy. Please call us at 212-964-3502 for a free consultation. That's Lawrence H. Bloom at 212-964-3502. We make people happy.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Welcome back. I'm Tony Martinetti, the host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. I'm joined now by Stephanie Strom, reporter for the New York Times. She is the nonprofit beat reporter for the Times. Stephanie, thank you very much for joining me in the studio.
Thank you, Tony, for inviting me.
On August 16th, you had an article that was titled Nonprofits Review Technology Failures, and you were covering something called Fail Fair that was sponsored by the World Bank. Sounds like it was fun. Tell us about Fail Fair.
Well, Fail Fair, it's actually an event that was cooked up by an organization called Mobile Active, which is a network of nonprofits working to use technology to bring social benefits, primarily internationally, but also locally. It's how do we use the gadgets that all of us have in our lives to make the lives of the poor and the needy better. And the World Bank had been to the first of these events in New York, and it decided it would be fun to have one in Washington in its offices because the World Bank certainly has a lot of failures to share. It's got a new transparency policy, and it thought this would be a great way to advance that. And it was a very fun event because it's done as a cocktail party type of event, so people are very relaxed. Presenters make a presentation of an example of a failure or several examples of a failure of technology to deliver the social goods that people, Western aid or nonprofit agencies would have expected. And the idea is that by doing this in a very relaxed setting, people will accept the story of the failure and maybe take away some lessons from it that they can then apply to their own work so that they don't make the same mistakes.
Were there other participants there besides the World Bank?
Yes, I would say about half of the presenters were World Bank employees, and the other half came from a wide variety of different types of organizations. Some of them were consultants that had done research. Some of them were actual employees of the organizations.
What was one of the failures that sticks out in your mind as memorable?
Well, the one that I discussed in the story at the top of the story was one that really sort of crystallized it. Several years ago, the telephone company in Guyana decided that as a gesture of corporate, so what we would call corporate social philanthropy or social responsibility, it would set up a telecom center in a very remote part of the Amazon. And a group of very enterprising women who probably had never used a telephone figured out that they could sell these beautiful woven hammocks that they make over the internet. They developed quite an international market for these things and ended up collecting about $17,000. Well, this upset the traditional power structure, which was male dominant, and their husbands literally pulled the plug on the darn thing and said, no more selling over the internet. We don't like this thing. Forget it. And that was the end of that.
So in that case, it was the husbands, not donors to the program, but husbands that pulled the plug.
Husbands, village elders, men.
Right. And the lesson there was that there was an upset to the culture.
Right. The lesson was that if you're going, you know, one of the presenters said it much more eloquently than I can, but that we often go in expecting technology. Technology works in our culture because our culture has adopted it, embraced it, developed it. But when we kind of just plop it down willy-nilly in another culture and anticipate that it will work the same way that it does in ours, we often run into trouble.
Admitting mistakes, then. You said the World Bank has a policy of openness and transparency about their failures, their mistakes. This is not something that we typically see in the larger nonprofit community.
Right. Well, the World Bank, I think back in April, adopted it's really a data transparency policy. But data, of course, is going to show you mistakes. So this is all part of trying to be more open, sharing what we know, what we've learned with everyone so that people don't make the same mistakes, learn something from it. Nonprofits are reluctant to discuss failure, I have found, because they don't necessarily want to discourage donors. Donors may not look at a failure as a learning experience. Donors may look at it as why would I give money to this organization that failed in this program or in this way?
And that really is the $64,000 question, I think. How are donors going to react to their money having been devoted to something that didn't have the outcomes we want?
Well, I think most donors prefer, of course, that their money go towards things that bring benefit.
Sure.
But I also think that there are, at least among sophisticated donors, donors who understand that sometimes things don't work out. Many of the wealthiest donors today are guys who became wealthy because of venture capital. And in venture capital, of course, for every huge success like eBay, there are 10 or 20 failures.
And they're accustomed to evaluating those failures. So our hope is that that will translate to their giving to nonprofits.
That's right.
That's the community's hope. Stephanie Strom's article on August 16th was online, a Nonprofits Review Technology Failures. You can follow Stephanie on Twitter. Her ID there is @SSStrom. I follow her. She follows me. Thank you for that. And I'm very grateful that her coverage brought her to the studio today. Thank you very much, Stephanie.
Thank you, Tony.
We'll be back after this break with Ken Cerini, and we'll be talking about keeping your nonprofit out of trouble. This is Tony Martinetti, Nonprofit Radio.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Hi, I'm New York State Senator Joe Addabbo. I will be hosting a job fair on Friday, November 12th at Aqueduct Racetrack in Queens from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. We will have over 100 companies looking for qualified workers. There will also be lectures on job strategies and networking. So come and bring plenty of resumes and join me on Friday, November 12th at Aqueduct Racetrack for a job fair from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. For more information, please call Pete in my district office at 718-738-1111.
I really need to take better care of myself. If only I had someone to help me with my lifestyle. I feel like giving up.
Is this you? Mind over matter, health and fitness can help. If you're expecting an epiphany, chances are it's not happening. Mind over matter, health and fitness can help you get back on track or start a new life in fitness. Join Joshua Margolis, fitness expert, at 212-865-9290 or visit www.mindovermatternyc.com.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
This is the Talking Alternative Network. I'm Tony Martinetti, the host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. My guest now is Ken Cerini. Ken is managing partner at Cerini & Associates, which is an accounting, audit, and management consulting firm. Ken has an impressive array of acronyms following his name. Ken is a CPA, of course, Certified Public Accountant, also CFP, Certified Financial Planner, and DABFA, Diplomat of the American Board of Forensic Accountants. As a diplomat, I'm going to ask him if that comes with parking privileges in New York City. I'd like to have his license plates if it does. Ken has a lot of experience working with large publicly traded companies, small closely held companies, and of course, nonprofits, both at his firm, Cerini & Associates, and also at Ernst & Young. Cerini & Associates does a lot of strategic and management consulting, which includes budget and cash flow analysis, contract reviews, compensation reviews, and negotiated settlements with government agencies. And I'm very glad that Ken's work brings him to the show today. Ken Cerini, welcome.
Thanks a lot for having me, Tony.
My pleasure. Small and medium nonprofits are facing something now with the IRS, their potential loss of tax-exempt status if they haven't filed their 990 lately. Can you help us explain what's going on there?
Sure, no problem. What happened back in, prior to 2007, nonprofit organizations that generated under $25,000 worth of annual revenue were really not required to file tax returns. Basically, if they were smaller organizations, the government said, don't bother filing. It would take too much paperwork and everything else to do these filings. Over the years, though, the number of nonprofits that have built up on the IRS system has grown to be tremendous levels, and to manage that database, it's costing the IRS a tremendous amount of money.
There's something like 1.2 or 1.3 million nonprofits now, is that right?
That's a very, very large number, yes.
Yeah, and a large percentage of those are under that $25,000 threshold, right, or very close to it?
I'd say a very, very large percentage of those. Here in New York, which is where I'm from, the number of nonprofits that are generating under $1 million worth of annual revenue is probably close to about 40% of the total nonprofits that exist.
So yes.
Most of the nonprofits that exist out there are smaller nonprofit organizations.
And that's exactly consistent with what I see on Charity Navigator statistics, that I think that same 40% number, 40% of the nonprofits generating very low, sort of low levels, mid to low levels of revenue.
That's
but
correct.
So I'm sorry, go ahead, please continue.
So what I was saying is, so then in 2007, the IRS said, in order for us to really gain an understanding of which of these nonprofits are still in existence, or maybe some of these nonprofits don't really exist anymore, they set up a new filing requirement, which is really just a one of those I am here type filings, where it's a postcard, a form 990N, that you just file electronically to let the government know that you're still in existence and you're still functioning as a nonprofit organization.
And that literally is a postcard. That's the filing.
It's for all practical purposes, yeah. It's three or four questions and you're done. So the IRS, and again, it gets filed electronically. So the IRS said, if we don't hear from you for your 2007 filing, your 2008 filing, and your 2009 filing, we're going to automatically assume that you no longer exist as a nonprofit organization, and we're going to terminate your tax-exempt status. So this is a problem that many nonprofit organizations find themselves in right now, because all along they've never had to do any sort of filing, and then the rules changed 3 years ago, and now they're being asked to file, even though it's very simplistic, they're being asked to file some level of filing, and if they don't know about it and they're not following the changes in the IRS regulations, it's possible that unbeknownst to them, they get terminated as a nonprofit organization and they no longer exist.
Yes, and we're talking about the smallest organizations that are apt to not have the expertise that tracks, new IRS regulations, new being back in 2007.
Typically, these are organizations that rely heavily upon volunteers. So they're using a lot of their board of directors are probably unsophisticated. They're focused on the core mission and really minor activities that they're doing, and they're really not focusing on the changes that are happening out there in the IRS.
So what can an organization do to find out, A, if it's at risk, and then B, if it is, how can they get into compliance?
The IRS has if you go to irs.gov, which is the IRS's website, and you look up exempt organizations, the IRS has a listing of those organizations as of June 30th that had not yet filed, and it's broken out by state. And in New York State alone, there's 21,578 nonprofits on this list.
Mm. And that is the list of organizations at risk of automatic revocation of tax-exempt status. That's the heading on that page.
That's correct.
Okay.
So these are the ones. And again, the list hasn't been updated, as far as I know, since June 30th. So this is a little outdated. So an organization who has recently filed may find themselves on this list. But they need to understand that that's because the information is as of June 30th. Organizations that are December 31st year-end filers have until October 15th to come in compliance. If they don't come into compliance by October 15th, and that's actually an extended date. It was originally May 15th, and the IRS gave organizations an additional time frame till October 15th. But if they don't come into compliance by October 15th, they are going to lose their revocation. They're going to have their, exempt. Organizations revoked.
I think IRS was concerned about what was going to happen with that original date, and there was a fair amount of popular press leading up to that date, but still the vast majority of organizations didn't take advantage of coming into compliance, so I think they were sort of forced to extend it lest, many hundreds of thousands of organizations lose their status.
Yeah, yes, and again, the answer may be that many of these organizations are not functioning anymore. have ceased to function over the years, and you know, losing their exempt status is not a big deal. But I'm sure looking down the list, there are some organizations that are still functioning and you know, really have no idea that this is happening and really stand to be in a position where you know, they find themselves on October 16th, their exempt status is gone, and they could be putting donors at risk, they can be putting the organization at risk, their board at risk, and everything else.
My guest is Ken Cerini, managing partner of Cerini and Associates. We are live today taking your calls. The call-in number is 877-480-4120. 877-480-4120. Now, if you were listening to the Divorce Hour with Larry Bloom right before this show, you heard Larry say that this was our first live show. But Larry's show was an archive edition, a pre-recorded. So we've had a plethora, live shows. I believe this is our third live show. So don't be discouraged, whether it's our first or third, or it really is many, many more, which it's not. Please call in if you have questions at 877-480-4120. Ken, how is the recession that we are still in the midst of affecting smaller organizations in terms of, I think in terms of cash flow?
I think what you find out there, that most nonprofit organizations, if you think about the economy, there are more people out of work. There are businesses are not doing as well, so there's less money flowing to the nonprofit sector. We see out there that the amount of contributions and fundraising going to the nonprofit sector is down somewhere in the 25% to 30% range.
Yes.
And has been over the last probably year and a half. So, you know, you've got these organizations that are receiving much less money than what they're used to. And what we find, and I think it's kind of borne out across the country, is that the number one funding source for nonprofit organizations is government grants is probably number one. And number two, especially for the smaller organization, is contributions and fundraising. So, you know, organizations rely very, very heavily upon these government grants coming in, and they rely extremely heavily upon the contribution income that's coming in. So when that income is down 25%, 30%, there's going to be much more of an onus on the government grants and making sure that government funding is flowing on a regular basis.
Yes. Let me just say, much more focus on the need for the government grants.
Yeah, the government's grants flowing in so that helps to buoy or bolster the cash flow that they have.
And all happening.
One other quick comment before I get back to that.
Yes.
You're in a situation where, especially in the health and welfare type organizations that provide benefits to people, the fact that there's a higher level of unemployment, there's a higher level of stress in people's lives, people are turning more towards alcohol, drugs, things like that because of the stresses in their lives. You're in a situation where the level of need for service is up. So you've got an increase in level of need for service, and you've got a decrease in the funding that's coming in. And then, as I mentioned before, so they're relying more heavily on government funding. Now, one of the problems that you have is, you know, in this environment that we find ourselves in, not only is it that the individuals and businesses are having cash flow constraints and problems, but the government is having some issues too. So the government has been cutting back on some of the funding that it's done. On top of that, the government, because they haven't been able to get their budgets passed, because, strains on cash flow at the governmental level, has also slowed down the payments that they're making to the nonprofit sector, which is kind of adding to the problem. So, you know, you've got nonprofit organizations that are seeing decreases in funding to begin with, and then on top of it, the government funding, which is supposed to be, you know, that constant, that rock that's there on an annual basis, is either starting to dry up a little or is taking longer to get in the doors, and it's creating all sorts of cash flow issues for the nonprofit sector.
And what are you counseling your clients who find themselves in this situation?
What organizations really need to do, it's all about communication. I mean, I think communication is something that's extremely important. So it really comes back down to communication. A lot of these organizations need to go out and talk to their banks and develop banking relationships early on in the process. You know, they need to make sure that the banks understand that the money will be there. It's just a matter of time. You know, banks are starting to look at the nonprofits, and their receivables of the nonprofit organizations are aging out a little further than they normally would be, which makes the nonprofit look like they're less bankable.
So just explain that a little bit. Why is an aged receivable less appealing to a bank or less bankable?
Because when a bank looks at a nonprofit organization's receivables, they're looking at it in terms of are these receivables collectible? And typically what happens is the older a receivable is, the less likely that an organization is going to collect that receivable. Usually receivables, once they start aging out, usually means that maybe there's something wrong with that receivable, and that's why the money hasn't come in yet. Unfortunately, in today's environment, it's not always because the receivable is not a good one. A lot of times it's because, you know, the cash flows constraints that the governmental agencies are having. Again, here in New York, it took a long time to get the budget passed. And since the budget wasn't passed on a timely basis, there were delays in getting contracts signed. Because the contracts were delayed in getting signed, there was delays in getting the monies out to nonprofit organizations. And it becomes, you know, this domino effect. And a lot of organizations were left there trying to figure out, how am I going to pay my payroll?
So even though the entity that owes the money is a government agency, the bank still looks at that as a less likely to be received?
I think that's where it comes into that communication piece, where nonprofit organizations need to be able to go to the banks and say, hey, look, here's what's happening out there in the marketplace. We have government grants. Those government grants are going to come in. Here's the signed contract. We're going to get the money, even though it's been aged out more than typical, because maybe the bank is used to seeing the nonprofit collect the money in 60 to 90 days, and now it's 120, 150 days out. By having that communication, by developing that strong open communication line with the banker that you're working with, it really can help to ensure that the lines of credit and the cash flow continue to flow into the nonprofit organization while the organization is waiting for government grants to free up.
And when we talk about aged, is that you mentioned the 120 to 150 days? Is that roughly the time at which a bank or other potential credit agency is likely to start calling these receivables aged? Is that roughly the time frame?
Somewhere in that range, when you start getting to that 120, 150, 180, it becomes a lot less attractive. Typically, banks like to see the money collected within 90 days. And for the most part, most nonprofits really should collect their money within the 90-day period of time, especially when they're relying heavily upon fee-for-service government-type monies. Again, unfortunately, in today's economy, that's not happening.
So banks would be open to this kind of a conversation? I mean, this sounds a lot like the advice we hear in the popular press. If you're having trouble with your mortgage, that you should pick up the phone and call the lender. So in this case, banks are willing to have this kind of a conversation? I mean, they'll take this kind of a call?
You have a relationship already with the bank. It's been, you know, you've had that relationship for a period of time. The banks really, from a working with the nonprofit sector, the banks really don't want to pull loans from nonprofits. It really doesn't look good for them either. And banks get credits working with the nonprofit sector. So it's a positive that the banks want to work with the sector. So they just want to know that their loan is going to be a good loan, and that, you know, that there's rationale and reasons behind what's taking place. And if you open up those lines of communication, they're going to be much more responsive than if you just send them something and say, we need more money.
And Ken, in just the 45 seconds or so we have before a break, are you finding that nonprofits are doing this, or are they more sort of staying in their shell and just maybe cowering?
I don't think they're doing it as much as they should. That's not to say that they're not doing it. It just, I always believe that in business, you need to be very proactive in your approach to dealing with the professionals that you work with, and that you need to reach out and keep those lines of communication open, because if you don't, then problems can occur. If you do, then everybody's on the same page, and at least you know if the bank is going to have a problem with it, you know up front, you know you need to seek alternatives.
So the tip really is pick up the phone, talk to your banker before you start to see a problem, and head off a potential crisis in cash flow.
That's correct.
My guest is Ken Cerini. We're going to take a break, and when Ken returns with us, we'll talk a little about his work in compensation reviews and maybe some excess compensation problems. This is Tony Martinetti, Nonprofit Radio. Stay with us.
Talking Alternative Radio, 24 hours a day.
Hi, I'm New York State Senator Joe Addabbo. I will be hosting a job fair on Friday, November 12th at Aqueduct Racetrack in Queens from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. We will have over 100 companies looking for qualified workers. There will also be lectures on job strategies and networking. So come and bring plenty of resumes and join me on Friday, November 12th at Aqueduct Racetrack for a job fair from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. For more information, please call Pete in my district office at 718-738-1111.
Are you suffering from aches and pains? Has traditional medicine let you down? Are you tired of taking toxic medications? Then come to the Double Diamond Wellness Center and learn how our natural methods can help you to heal. Call us now at 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. Or find us on the web at www.doublediamondwellness.com. We look forward to serving you.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
I'm Tony Martinetti. My guest is Ken Cerini, managing partner of Cerini & Associates. Ken, if someone would like to contact you, how is the best way to do that?
I could be reached either by email, which is kenc@cerini-associates.com, all spelled out, C-E-R-I-N-I-A-N-D-associates.com, or by phone, 631-582-1600, and my extension is 203.
Thank you. And the Cerini & Associates website is www.cerini.com. CERINIAND associates.com. Ken, there has been a fair amount of popular press about excessive compensation for CEOs and other C-level people at nonprofits. Part of your work is compensation reviews. I'd like to spend the remaining time, a few minutes we have, talking about how a nonprofit can determine whether they're paying excessive compensation.
The IRS has established some rules regarding excessive compensation under Internal Revenue Code Section 4958, which deals with what's known as intermediate sanctions. So really what the IRS came out and said, and this was a result of some of the abuses that happened back in the late 90s, where the IRS said, you know, we can't really take away a nonprofit's exempt status if they are overpaying their executive director. So what we're going to do is we're going to charge penalties to both the executive director and any board members who knowingly participate in that overpayment.
And rather than pull the
exempt status, which was really the only teeth the IRS had back then.
The interim sanction is these penalties?
I'm sorry, what?
Is that the interim sanction?
The intermediate sanction.
Are
these penalties that the IRS now imposes, and these penalties are very, very steep. They could be as high as 50% of the excess compensation. So they're very, very steep. So what happens is nonprofit organizations, and this typically more affects larger organizations than smaller, but it really comes down to the salary levels that are being paid. Nonprofit organizations need to really understand that whether the salaries they're paying the key individuals within the organization, which is usually the executive director and other top-level management, is appropriate compensation. And when you look at compensation, you kind of look at the whole package. So it looks at not just the salary that's being paid, but any other benefits that go with it. And the 990 form, which is the tax return that nonprofits are required to file, really has it very clear with on the form, not just the organization itself, but any related organizations that are associated with that nonprofit organization. It asks really targeted questions on how much money is being paid to this organization. So it makes it very, very easy for the IRS to identify the level of compensation that this individual is receiving.
And Ken, in just the short amount of time that we have left, just about a minute, what can a nonprofit do to see whether they're paying excessively?
The easiest way to handle this is really to go back, and if you go online and you do some research, you can find some salary surveys that are out there online. There's some that you can pay for, but there are others that are free. And what you want to do is you want to look to see if the compensation that the executive director is getting compensated is in line with the other compensations for similar size organizations doing similar things that your organization does in a similar area of the country. The other thing you can do is you can actually go to GuideStar.org, which is where all the 990s are posted for all of the nonprofit organizations. And you can look at other organizations within your community that are very similar to the organization that you know that you are. And you can take the information of what their executive directors or their chief people are getting, compare it to your organization to see if you fall in line with what the other compensations are or whether you're outside of the realm of what the average is for the group.
Thank you very much.
And when you look at it, it's something, A, that we typically recommend that is done by the board or by a compensation committee of the board so that it really gets an independent review. And when you look at this and you the board or the independent compensation committee are reviewing it and approving it, you want to make sure that if the salary does fall outside of the realm, that there's at least a process going through to say why the individual deserves more than what the average is, and there's a rationale for that decision-making process.
Ken, we are out of time, but those are excellent ideas and both free ways, simple ways of doing a benchmark to determine whether you might be at risk of this excessive compensation problem. My guest has been Ken Cerini, managing partner of Cerini and Associates. Ken, I want to thank you very much for being on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio.
Tony, I want to thank you for having me. Thanks.
My pleasure. Thank you. I'm going to bring now a guest from San Francisco, Gene Takagi. Gene is an attorney for nonprofits, and we're going to talk about some techniques to keep your board out of trouble. Gene, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tony. It's a pleasure to be here.
My pleasure to have you. We're taking calls. Again, we're live today, 877-480-4120. Taking calls for Gene Takagi if you have some. Gene, we hear the phrase board governance. What does that mean?
Well, it means a few things, Tony. I think from a legal perspective, it means that the board is responsible to exercise its duty of care and its duty of loyalty and duty of obedience in overseeing the operations and management of the organization. The directors of a board are ultimately responsible for the control and operations of the nonprofit, so providing oversight or governance is the way that that's exercised.
And so that, very interesting, that duty of care, loyalty, and obedience. And I neglected to say when I brought Gene on that his practice in San Francisco, but nationwide, is in compliance, governance, and nonprofit law. And Gene is the author of the nonprofit blog, which you'll find at, nonprofit law blog, which you will find at nonprofitlawblog.com. And I'll bet you could go there right now. Now, don't close this window that you're listening from, but if you can open another window simultaneously, you can listen to Gene and at the same time read his writings on nonprofitlawblog.com. You can follow Gene on Twitter, as I do. He is at GTAK on Twitter. And Ken does an enormous amount of speaking also. He also serves on local nonprofit and exempt organization boards, advisory boards. And so that makes him eminently qualified to talk about these subjects, board governance and nonprofit law generally. Let's flesh out the sort of this board governance a little bit, Gene. How do these duties of care, loyalty, and obedience translate to actions that the board should be taking and individual board members should be taking?
Sure. Well, I think there are triple ways to look at it from a practical perspective and not just a legal perspective as well. So the board is responsible really for directing the organization, for providing oversight over the organization, and also for protecting the organization and its assets, which may be held in charitable trust if the organization or nonprofit is a charitable nonprofit. With those three duties, and part of the protection, the other part of the P, is planning. The board is responsible for planning the direction of the organization as well. So in meeting a board's fiduciary duties, the duty of care, the duty of loyalty, and duty of obedience, the board has really got to be active in terms of attending meetings, in terms of providing oversight over the financial activities of the organization, and part of that is regularly receiving financial reports that speak to the financial health of the organization, and boards must understand how to read those financial statements, maybe not with the same type of precision and detail that a CPA might be looking at it, but certainly with the level of understanding that they can react appropriately when it's clear to an ordinary prudent person or an average reasonable person that the organization may be facing some sort of financial difficulties.
Gene, is there any obligation, or maybe it's just a good idea that that a nonprofit actually provide some training to board members in reading financial statements?
I think that's absolutely true, Tony. That might be part of the duties of the executive director or CEO of the organization to facilitate that type of board development, and where there are no staff members, certainly up to the president or chair of the board and the CFO or treasurer, training the board to get them comfortable in reading financials and regularly encouraging board development and facilitating it as well, I think are very, very important parts of an officer's duties.
And since you mentioned training, what about new board members? So we just talked about, you just explained for us the training on reading financial statements, but what else should a nonprofit, the organization itself, be doing to support new board members who have just joined the organization?
Well, I think a governance committee, if the board is large enough to support such a committee, or the board itself, has got to be involved in board development in four areas. First, in the recruitment of directors. Clearly, you have to select the right people who are willing to serve the governance functions of the organization. And you're not just picking based on how much fundraising they can do, or how involved they are maybe as volunteers in the activities, the programmatic activities of the organization, but you really want to pick people who are capable and who want to exercise their governance duties. Orientation is the next part, and I think that was what you were speaking about.
Yes.
Bringing new board members in and making sure that they are aware of things like the governing documents of the organization, its articles of incorporation and its bylaws. These are documents that shouldn't just sit on the shelf, because part of the duty of obedience, or one of the fiduciary duties of the board, is to operate in compliance with applicable laws, including the organization's internal laws, which are usually documented in the articles and bylaws, and maybe other policies like a conflict of interest policy, whistleblower policy, etc. So orienting the board with respect to, or new board members with respect to, the organization's internal laws and general fiduciary duties, I think is really important. And a board handbook with a job description, with board expectations, and an understanding of what the organization does, what its mission is, the programmatic activities, all of that is really important. And actually, that's really important on the recruitment end as well. But once a new director is in there, they should have a board manual, a board book, perhaps a mentor on the board to help guide the organization through, and then regular trainings after that.
And Gene, you said there are four elements. We've covered two, recruitment and orientation. I'm going to interrupt you for a moment because we have a call on line one. Is this Mary?
Hi. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mary, welcome to the show. You have a question for Gene.
I do. First, I want to thank you for addressing that new 990N, the new filings with the IRS. That was great information to have.
Excellent. Thank you very much. What's your question for Gene?
Well, I struggle sometimes with board expectations, and I find that some board members tend to get very, very involved and into sort of business that they don't necessarily need to be involved in, and then others are completely absent. And you started to talk about orientation and recruitment, and then I lost the rest of it. I'm wondering how to sort of establish those boundaries and really get them involved in things you want them to be involved in.
So we're talking really about the organization setting expectations for its board members. Gene, how should the organization be doing that?
That may be one of the most difficult questions I've fielded, and one that many nonprofits struggle with. the relationship between the executive director and the board is a critical component to an organization being able to further its mission effectively and efficiently. And when you have a brand new organization, it's a little bit easier to do because we can set out board expectations on the recruitment side. So once you bring in board members, they have an idea of what their expectations may be. So in your recruitment materials, a job description, sort of the boundaries of where a director's duties are and where they stop and where the manager or executive director's duties are and where they stop and where there's some overlap, that can all be established. There's still a lot of gray and overlap between governance and management, so it's not an easy thing, but it's easier to do with a new organization. With an existing organization, it's really tough. I don't have a quick, snappy 30-second answer to that, but this may be a time when a consultant or an attorney who's got experience in governance who can speak to the board about its legal duties and its roles will be able to, I think, help define the board's duties and see that it will help directors see that they've got a lot on their plate without infringing in the areas of day-to-day management, which really belong to the executive director.
Mm-hmm. So almost have a third party in there.
Yeah, having a consultant can really help. Again, this is with a more established organization that's been running and that's been having difficulties with this. The board may not be willing to respond so easily to an executive director who says, well, you're infringing on my territory. This is where the boundaries should be, because the executive director really serves at the pleasure of the board. And so the board may feel a little uncomfortable receiving directions from the ED.
But
when it comes from an outside consultant and sometimes when it comes from a lawyer, it can hold a little bit more authority and it might be treated a little bit more objectively.
We see the same thing, actually, Gene, in fundraising. There are things that consultants can persuade boards of that the CEO or executive director is just unable to. Mary, I want to thank you very much for your question.
Thanks very much.
We're going to take a break. And when we return, Gene Takagi will stay with us.
You are listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
Are you stuck in your business or career? Trying to take your business to the next level and it keeps hitting a wall? This is Sam Leibowitz, the Conscious Consultant. I will help you get to the root cause of your abundance issues and help move you forward in your life. Call me now and let's create the future you dream of. 212-721-8183. That's 212-721-8183. The Conscious Consultant, helping conscious people be better business people.
This is Tony Martinetti, the aptly named host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Technology, fundraising, compliance, social media. Small and medium nonprofits have needs in all these areas. My guests are expert in all these areas and more. Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, Fridays, 1 to 2 Eastern, on Talking Alternative Broadcasting.
Is your marriage in trouble? Are you considering divorce? Hello, I'm Lawrence Bloom, a family law attorney in New York and New Jersey. No one is happier than the day their divorce is final. My firm can help you. We take the nasty out of the divorce process and make people happy. Please call us at 212-964-3502 for a free consultation. That's Lawrence H. Bloom at 212-964-3502. We make people happy.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
I'm the host of Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, and I'm joined by Gene Takagi. Gene, we got another call on the break, so we're going to talk to Stacy. You with us, Stacy?
Yes.
Stacy, welcome to the show. What's your question for Gene?
Hi. I work for a small nonprofit, and he was mentioning about the board. And I'm wondering, when you're starting up a nonprofit, is it wise to have a mix of professionals on your board, like a mix of professionals with diverse backgrounds? So, like, ideally, what types of professionals would you pick on, like, a 10-member board of a small nonprofit, you know, from, like, lawyers to financial planners? Like, who are the people who are important to be on that board?
Thank you, Stacy.
So that background.
Thank you, Stacy. So that question, Gene, really goes to recruitment, the first of the four things, which I hope we get to. What about that diversity on your board in recruiting?
I think that's a great consideration to bring to the table when your founding members decide on who to recruit for the board.
Gene, can you talk a little bit louder, please, or move the phone maybe closer to you?
Sure. Is this a little bit better,
yes.
Tony?
Yes, it is. Thank you.
Great. I think it's great to have a skills matrix when you're recruiting your board. And if that's possible, if you have enough recruits so that you can be selective and you can get some professionals in various areas, I think that would be ideal. Having somebody with an accounting background, perhaps somebody with an investment background, somebody with a legal background, and somebody who's worked in the nonprofit sector before, perhaps in fundraising, perhaps as an executive director. Those would all be ideal individuals to have. Diversity in other areas besides skills may also be important. Diversity so that you include perhaps some segment of the beneficiaries that your charity serves. Having them represented on the board can bring a diversity of issues to you as well. So I think it's ideal to have those skills matrices, but sometimes it's a luxury to have all those people because on top of all of these things, you need people who are really willing to fill their duties, their legal duties as boards of directors, and be diligent about providing oversight over the organization. Not just financial oversight, which we've been focused on so far, but definitely programmatic oversight, because after all, nonprofits aren't in existence to make a profit. The financials are really important, but only insofar as they are there to help fulfill the charitable mission as effectively and efficiently as possible. So programmatic oversight, ultimately important for boards.
Yes, they need to love the work that you do. In addition to having whatever professional expertise they do, they need to love your work.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stacy, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Gene, I hope we have time. I'll try to make sure we do have time. You had said there are four things to consider, and we got through recruitment and orientation. Let's continue. What else should organizations be conscious about board members?
Great. The third way that an executive may be able to help in board development is through training. So we talked about recruitment, then orientation, and training is sort of the ongoing trainings that an executive director or board president may facilitate for the rest of the board. And this could be done by periodic distributions of materials to the board. If the executive or chair comes across important information regarding governance, short, snappy articles regularly distributed to board members may be really helpful. Bringing in consultants, we've already talked about. Once a year, having a consultant come in and talking about fiduciary duties or specific duties with respect to finances or with respect to programmatic management or fundraising, having those people come in will generate more interest among the board, and those types of trainings would be good. Again, oftentimes it's more helpful to bring an outsider in. If it's a volunteer, that's great, so long as that person is qualified to give that training. But training the board, that's the third thing. And the fourth thing, which sort of overlaps with the trainings, which I think I've already discussed about, is to ensure that the board is adequately getting information before board meetings about the actions that they're going to take at that board meeting. So they need to get the information well in advance so that they can prepare for the board meeting and make informed decisions, because that's key to meeting their fiduciary duties.
A guest on a previous show, Gene, had made the point that a lot of the administrative work should be done in advance so that board meetings can actually be more engaging and there can be people, maybe guest speakers at a board meeting. But not to lose sight of the important administrative work, just do as much of the administrative work as possible in advance.
I think that's absolutely right.
Jean, in just the minute or so that we have left, what's your advice on CEOs on boards?
Well, Tony, it's a difficult situation, but I think the general rule is that the CEO or executive director should not be on the board of directors. Mm. That would be the general rule, and there may be some exceptions to this. But I think even in the case of exceptions, it's a best practice for organizations to work towards having a strong enough board that the executive does not need to be a voting member of the board. This does not mean that the executive would not be invited to attend board meetings, except when the board goes into executive session. But the reasons for this are really because of the conflicts of interest that the executive director may have in serving on the board. The executive serves at the pleasure of the board, and the board is responsible for providing oversight over the executive. So typically, in the for-profit sector, with public companies, you don't see the CEO on the board of directors because they're going to report to the board, and you have that check and balance there. With new, small nonprofits, sometimes you see the CEO or ED on the board. But again, I think it's a best practice to work to get that check and balance, to have an independent board.
My guest has been Gene Takagi, nonprofit attorney. You'll find him at nonprofitlawblog.com and also on Twitter at GTAK. Gene, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Tony.
I want to thank my guests today, Stephanie Strom and Ken Serini, and also Gene Takagi. Next week will be Karen Bradunas, human resources consultant. Your most coveted assets are the people who work for you. How do you attract the right people? Hire them, retain, train, and motivate them. And when it doesn't work out, how do you move them on? All done legally to keep your nonprofit's reputation safe. That's next Friday, September 3rd. My guest for the hour will be Karen Bradunas. I want to thank creative producer Claire Meyerhoff, line producer Sam Leibowitz, and our social media is by Regina Walton. Speaking of social media, we have a Facebook fan page, facebook.com/Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Head over there and like us. This is Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio on Talking Alternative Broadcasting. Please join us next Friday, 1 p.m. Eastern.